This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And I think it's brought about a realization of the cruelty with which political prisoners, whether Morsi, other members of the Muslim Brotherhood, or members of many other political groups, are being treated.
That's Michelle Dunn, Director of Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, on reaction to the death of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Details coming up. Also, this month, intercommunal violence in Congo's Ituri province has forced more than 300,000 people to flee for their lives. And the Ebola virus crossing from the Democratic Republic of Congo into Uganda has brought trade along the border region of the two countries to a virtual halt. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, was buried today after he collapsed in a Cairo courtroom and died. Only around 10 family members and close Morsi confidants were present, accompanied by police. Journalists were prevented from entering the site. Amnesty International urged Egyptian authorities to open an impartial, thorough, transparent investigation into his death. Human Rights Watch echoed that demand, saying Morsi suffered years of insufficient access to medical care. Morsi's death comes days before Egypt hosts the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament. Authorities have been on high alert, announcing on Facebook yesterday that thousands of forces would be deployed to secure venues. Michelle Dunn, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about what Morsi's death means for Egyptian politics.
One thing that the death of Morsi has brought about is an outpouring of sympathy from the Egyptian public, including from people who were not supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood or of Morsi as president. And I think it's brought about a realization of the cruelty with which political prisoners, whether Morsi, other members of the Muslim Brotherhood, or members of many other political groups are being treated. Now, with the political effects of this, I think will take some time to see. There's a possibility that Morsi's death could be a factor that contributes to building bridges across ideological lines, that is, between different factions within the Brotherhood, as well as between Islamists and non-Islamists.
But Muslim Brotherhood insisted for years that Morsi is a legitimate elected president and he should be reinstated. Would his departure pave the way for any sort of political compromise?
There was a difference even inside the Brotherhood itself as to whether reinstating Morsi in the presidency should be the main goal or not. So now that issue is removed with his death, and at least within the Brotherhood and maybe between the Brotherhood and others, it might make it easier to agree on a set of political goals. Now, what I don't know is whether this would make it any easier for the Brotherhood or others to reconcile with the current regime in Egypt headed by President Sisi. I doubt that. That's not necessarily the case.
Would Egypt respond to rights groups' call for an impartial investigation into Morsi's sudden death?
I doubt that Egyptian authorities will agree to an impartial investigation. And even if they do, you know, they will try to avoid the recommendations. There have been many other cases. I think, for example, of the murder of Giulio Regeni, the Italian PhD student, of the attack on a convoy of Mexicans and one American citizen in the desert. I mean, some terrible things that have happened in the past, and Egyptian authorities have very much resisted impartial inquiries, and even if they allowed inquiries to be done, they then resist any kind of accountability. You know, and for Egyptian authorities, the problem with Morsi's death is we know this is not an isolated case. The treatment that Morsi had, prolonged solitary confinement, denial of medical treatment, denial of family visits, all these things that seem to have contributed to his premature death at age 67. That's a pervasive problem. And then this is why people should ask for an investigation. It would shed light on the kind of mistreatment that many other prisoners, and in particular political prisoners, are receiving.
What do you make of the Egyptian government's security measures all over the country as a precaution for any protests over Morsi's death?
You know, the Egyptian regime probably really doesn't know what the public support is at this point for the Muslim Brotherhood, for Islamists more generally, and they probably really don't know whether they should expect some sort of protest or not. And also, you know, there are other factors, economic hardships, the recent constitutional amendments that allow Sisi to stay in power for many years. There are other sources of public unhappiness with the regime right now. So what they're probably trying to do is prevent any possibility that all these different grievances against the regime would be linked and that people would turn this into some broad protest against the regime. After all, we see what's been happening in Algeria, in Sudan. The whole mass protest is not a phenomenon that has died. It's still very much a possibility, and that includes in the Arab region.
That was Michelle Dunn, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The UN Refugee Agency reports an upsurge of intercommunal violence in northeastern Congo's Ituri province has forced more than 300,000 people this month to flee for their lives. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The Hema and Lendu ethnic groups in Ituri province have been going to war with each other sporadically over land use since 1999. Inter-ethnic fighting between the two communities in late 2017 and early 2018 was marked by widespread displacement and abuse. Unfortunately, the situation of calm over the past year has broken down again with the recent flare-up of fighting. The UN Refugee Agency reports masses of people are fleeing attacks and counterattacks in three of the Ituri province's five administrative territories. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balar says humanitarian agencies are unable to reach the victims in most of the affected areas.
UNHCR fears this escalation could engulf large parts of the province. We are gravely concerned for the safety of civilians after receiving reports of killings, kidnappings, maiming, and sexual violence being unleashed against people.
The epicenter of the Ebola epidemic in eastern DRC is in North Kivu province, but Ituri province also is affected. The World Health Organization reports the virus has infected more than 2,100 people and killed nearly 1,500. It says about 10% of these cases and deaths are in Ituri. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich tells VOA the massive displacement in Ituri will certainly complicate efforts to contain Ebola.
The mobility of the population in North Kivu and Ituri is a risk factor. So every time you have people moving in high numbers, it's more complicated to do the work on follow-ups, contact tracing, follow-up on people who are supposed basically to be observed for on a daily basis for 21 days.
Ebola symptoms emerge between 2 and 21 days after a person becomes infected. It is crucial for an infected person to seek treatment immediately. The UN Refugee Agency reports the hundreds of thousands of newly displaced in Ituri are in urgent need of shelter, basic household items, and food. It says tens of thousands of people are sleeping in the open or in public buildings without any practical assistance. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Last week, the Ebola virus crossed from the Democratic Republic of Congo into Uganda. Since then, the virus has not only claimed two lives, but also brought trade along the border region to a virtual halt. Halima Tumani has the story.
Businessman Peng Kis has been importing fish for the last 15 years from Uganda to the Democratic Republic of Congo. But for the last week, Kis says he has had little choice but to stay in Uganda because of the Ebola outbreak along the border. Kinshasa, we don't know Ebola. But when you get here at the border, wash hands, wash hands, wash hands. And when I got here, we've worked 3 days. In Congo, there is no business. They said there is Ebola, so we have to sit and wait, and even all the banks are closed. Motorcycle taxi driver Farouk Ayub says Ebola makes him afraid to cross into Congo. Normally, Congolese are the ones we transport mostly. We get them from Congo and take them to Uganda. But we are scared because of Ebola. So now we ask, we don't know how you can help advise us. How can we protect ourselves against Ebola? Ugandan businessman Raphael Masereka says he and his colleagues are warning people not to shake hands with merchants from the DRC. Ebola is spread through contact with body fluids. The Ugandan Red Cross is in charge of Ebola screening at all official entry points from the DRC. But Red Cross branch manager Natukunda Primrose says the danger is from those who cross the porous border where there is no screening.
So you don't know whether they've been in contact with a person who has Ebola, who has maybe attended a cultural function like burial, or maybe if through that process of trading, if they've managed to touch someone, a victim of Ebola.
Ugandan troops posted along the border have a mandate to check for illegal ammunition, but are not prepared to face, let alone fight Ebola. Benjamin Sensasi is the World Health Organization's health promotions and communications officer.
They'll be vaccinated if we get where they are. But the only challenge we have in that is the question of follow-up, which we're trying to work on. Because once you're given the vaccine, we need to follow you up for some time to ensure that everything is working okay with you, don't have any problem.
The traders along the Uganda-DRC border can only hope the measures are enough to stop Ebola's spread so life can return to business as usual. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kasese, Uganda.
17 past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Public health sector workers have notified Zimbabwe's government that they will work only 2 days this week, saying they need a pay raise because inflation has eroded their income in recent months. Reporter Kuzaza Nawashi has the details.
Panganai Chivese is the team leader of the Health Workers Apex Council. He explains the situation.
The major one is that we are unable to buy anything from the shops. We are unable to sustain our families. We are unable to send our children to school. We are unable to come to work because of transport costs. Currently, there isn't any movement from government.
Chivese says they will only go to work twice this week, not because they are striking, but because they are incapacitated. He says, as of next week, the bulk of health sector workers will not be able to even come to work. As troubling as this news may be to many Zimbabweans seeking health attention from public hospitals, political analyst Rashid Mukundu says the unfolding situation is expected.
The partial industrial action is a natural reaction, more so by workers who are struggling to make ends meet.
Zimbabwe's inflation rate is reported to be nearing 100%, but salaries of most workers in government and private sector have not been adjusted to match the increasing cost of living. Mukundu says the current situation in the health sector speaks to the larger economic and political crisis that the country is suffering. Pondering on solutions, Mukundu says political actors need to find common ground and have a vision they can all build toward. If negotiations between health sector workers and their employers do not happen soon, then Zimbabwe may have another fully blown strike by health workers. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Kigali-based lawyer Richard Mugishi has filed a lawsuit with the East African Court of Justice on behalf of three Rwandans who say they were illegally arrested and tortured by Ugandan security agencies. Eugene Wimana has details from Kigali.
Among the three Rwandans whom Mugisha is representing are Ezekiel Muhawenimana and Dusabimana Esperance. They say they were arrested in Rwanda, in Uganda, on their way to attend a funeral and that their last child was born in jail. The third plaintiff is Hakolimana Juvenal. He says was arrested in Kampala while traveling from Ethiopia where he taught biology in a Turkish school. All three Rwandans were tried by Ugandan courts on charges including illegal entry. Mugisha calls the charges baseless.
They were offloaded from a bus together with many other Rwandans and charged, taken to a police and charged with the illegal entry, which is ridiculous considering that they had gone through a known port of entry.
These three Rwandans were deported in April, but the suit has filed after Uganda deported 20 other Rwandans who said they had to spend several months in Uganda's chieftaincy of military intelligence facilities. The Rwandans we found there are very pitiful. There are some who lay down, but I could not see them. I was about to enter somewhere, I thought they were, but a soldier beat me. There is one of my neighbors, Eric, asked me to speak of their fate the first chance I got. Mugisha, who recently challenged Rwanda's new penal code, says he will represent his clients for free. He says that as an African lawyer, he has interest in rule of law to allow citizens move freely.
The rationale for the court was to ensure that disputes as and when they arise in the East African community are dealt with expeditiously and fairly. So I've got absolute confidence in the court.
Generally, Ugandans who are arrested in Uganda are charged with spies for the Ugandan government, which the government always dismisses. But Rwanda also accuses Uganda of hosting terror groups that intend to destabilize the country. These accusations are part of deteriorating relations over the past 5 years. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Kenya, one of Africa's most innovative countries, has taken a leading role in technological innovation, fueling development in markets across East Africa. Recently, the country hosted the Nairobi Innovation Week, a program designed to support and accelerate innovation and entrepreneurship in the region. From the Kenyan capital, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
During the two-day Nairobi Innovation Week, participants and officials expressed their commitment to supporting Kenya in creating employment and business opportunities as part of the country's agenda to fast-track economic growth. Phoebe Oriama, an innovator and a startup entrepreneur, was among several young people who displayed their innovations at the event. She says our startup aims to provide better access to locally made medical device solutions.
We're looking at providing solutions that are currently are gaps within the health industry, making sure that they're affordable and to also have after services like maintenance and repair locally, and also offering opportunities for employment.
Another Kenyan innovator is Angela Wanjiku. She has single-handedly created a lifestyle and fashion brand which she says seeks to address the needs of the visually impaired persons in the society.
I was thinking of how my skill would best apply to engage members of my community, connecting my passion with who they are and making an impact. So that's when I started thinking of visually impaired persons I had interacted with and how they interpreted fashion. It's making me aware and learn that design and tech and innovation are more about us lifting each other up and just using our purpose for good.
Kenyan officials said the annual event is designed to encourage local techies and startup entrepreneurs co-design solutions that have higher chances of tackling specific problems. According to the World Bank, Kenya accounts for 23% of all the agri-tech startups in Africa. Overall, it's among the most innovative countries on the continent. But there are challenges. Initial costs of implementing innovations are high, as Oriyama explains.
I feel like there's a disconnect between what the investor wants and what the solution is. If they don't really buy into it in as much as it's a needed solution, there's no faith that you would actually take the money and implement it. So I think that is probably one of the problems that we have to face. So matching the right investors with the right solutions is really important. And that's why I really applaud Nairobi Innovation Week, because then you have investors and supporters all coming together and looking and fishing for what the right support is.
Kenyans from all walks of life, including government officials, business executives and academics, came out in large numbers to witness the cutting-edge innovations on display. Lilac Osanjo is the director of School of Art and Design at the University of Nairobi.
Most of the products they produce are actually marketable, but that spark at which the market makes contact and actually pays for their goods has been the issue. The entry into the market has been the challenge. Well, the reforms is now them coming out and talking for themselves.
While Kenya remains a top innovation leader in Africa, it lacks the adequate skills that can produce a solid pool of internationally competitive technology-enabled businesses. The country also has limited contact between traditional industry and technology-enabled startups. For Kenyan women entrepreneurs, particularly those who own startups and small, medium enterprises, all these challenges are even more pronounced, as Wanjiku explains.
For me, my product is quite new, and even the tech we're using is quite new also. So the challenge has been that our products end up being quite expensive, and for me, I feel like accessibility for persons with disabilities should not be too expensive. So our challenge is in funding and creating the prototypes of the product.
Experts say in today's fast-paced globalized economy, startup-driven innovation is key for economic development in Africa, as it creates new jobs for the growing youth demographic. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. And thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, thousands of men, women and children are forced to flee to escape violence and persecution. June 20th marks World Refugee Day. Global refugee awareness on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey,
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.